I wouldn't advise that. Ambassador Spock's mission to Romulus may look very laudable to us, but from the Romulan perspective, he and his supporters are outliers. Reunification of Romulus and Vulcan? Hey, when I was a kid, I wanted a unicorn. With wings. I didn't get one. I didn't even get a damn pony.
A personal mission of peace, the ambassador calls it.
Well, the Romulans consider it very personal. Almost.
She scraped around for a word that wouldn't offend.
Idiosyncratic?
In other words, they think he's a crank.
He was most definitely smiling.
Carry on talking so frankly to me, Commander, he said, and we shall get along very well. Very well indeed.
The door buzzer sounded.
He called out, Come.
Call came in. Apologies for the interruption, sir, but you asked me to let you know immediately when the ship was ready for you.
Ah, yes, thank you, Call. Yes, I'll be on my way shortly.
He turned back to Rafi.
The starship Verity has been assigned to lead the First Fleet out to Romulan space. A nice name, don't you think?
Sure.
A true principle, especially one of fundamental significance.
He looked pleased.
I believe that remembering such things will be crucial to the success of our undertaking. Above all, we are on a mission to protect, preserve, and save lives.
Rafi nodded, faintly.
This meeting was not going in the slightest how she had anticipated. No presentation. He said he'd already watched it half a dozen times. He clearly didn't want it in person. For some reason, they were now discussing eternal verities.
She was a simple intelligence officer, maybe turned a mite suspicious by having to think like a Romulan 24 hours a day. She wasn't any kind of philosopher. Why was she here?
Lieutenant Cole, added Picard conversationally, was on staff here before even I was, seconded from Admiral Bordson's office. Their loss has been my gain. She'll be vital to operations here on Earth.
There it was again, that extraneous information, as if giving her a picture of the setup here. Sir, said Rafi, may I ask you something?
By all means, said the great man. You must always feel you can speak freely to me.
She'd never had any superior officer say that to her. Sometimes quite the contrary. This isn't a briefing, is it? Said Rafi. This is an interview.
That's correct, Commander. My apologies if I kept my cards close to my chest, but I wanted to see how you answered my questions face to face.
He sipped some of his revolting tea.
You've answered them most satisfactorily.
Which means,
I'd like you as my XO.
She put down her cup with a rattle. Tea spilled. Shit.
His mouth twitched. I sincerely hope not. Most certainly we have some difficult times ahead. More difficult than either of us can imagine.
She turned and looked out through the transparent aluminum partition into the busy office. All those people dashing about, putting the nuts and bolts of this mission together, building this operation from data, information, decisions, actions. Sure, it was easy to take the piss out of the pad pushers, but nothing could happen without them. Working out what was needed, where it could be found, how to get it all to the right place at the right time. She had no idea how to do this. She took a breath. How do you say no to a legend? Sir, she said, I'm not an administrator.
He blinked. I beg your pardon.
I mean, this is a flattering offer, sir. I hope you understand that. Truly flattering. But an operation like this? She gestured to the room beyond. I'm not cut out for this kind of work. I wouldn't know where to start.
She saw understanding dawn in his eyes. Ah. There has been a misunderstanding. I have a very able administrator arriving to head up the office here on Earth, Commander Crystal Bowie. She's on her way from Starbase 192 as we speak. She's worked with the UFPHCR coordinating numerous missions. She was on Bajor for a while after the occupation,
and on Cardassia Prime during the reconstruction effort there. Once she arrives, I shall move over to the fleet. This mission must get underway, and soon. He glanced out across the busy room. No, the appointment here is filled, I'm afraid. I'm sorry if that's a disappointment. His eyes were quietly twinkling with suppressed mirth. No, of course he didn't want her here. She'd be no damn good here, would she? Then... He leaned forward in his seat, held her eye, very serious now. I'm asking you to come aboard my ship, Commander. Be my first officer on the Verity. But I'm asking more than that, and I think you know it. I have left my crew behind on the Enterprise. I must replace them, and if I am to succeed, I need an excellent XO. And what I require above all from my XOs is honesty. I shall need you always to tell me the truth. What do you say? Is that something you believe that you could do? Shit, she thought, and managed not to say it out loud this time. No, this was not what she'd been expecting when she'd walked into this room. It's a big decision, he was saying. There may be all manner of ties keeping you here on Earth. Gabe had a soccer match next week. She'd missed the last one putting together that damn presentation.
When does the ship leave?
6 days. So she could make Gabe's match. But there would be the next match, or the match after, the long months away. The individual seconds and moments of simply being present that were tiny for her, but that constituted the whole of Gabe's life, his childhood. Damn, she wanted this post. She could do this job. She was made to do this job. She'd known the second she walked into this room that she wanted to work with this man in some way, but she'd never imagined she would be offered this. Right hand to a legend. Right in the middle of the greatest operation that Starfleet would ever mount. He was smiling at her. Would you like to see the ship, Commander? The Verity? You'd be spending a lot of time there, after all. You can make your decision after that.
Yes, she said, already knowing what her decision would be. I'd love to see the ship.
Utopia Planitia Shipyards, Mars. The construction sites and the skeletons of half-built ships obscured the view of the red planet below. LaForge watched the production drones zipping to and fro, the supply shuttles bringing out components and sub-assemblies. His own shuttle sped past the main shipyard and began its descent into a low orbit. With the bulk of the shipyards behind, the factory complex on the surface was now clearly visible. A huge domed structure at least 2 miles in diameter, a jewel set into the sandstone. Under the cover of the dome, LaForge knew, tucked into a deep crater, was the warren of offices, labs, and habitations that comprised the working and living spaces of the people who kept this whole vast operation up and running. A communication exchange with the folks on the ground, and he was ready to be transported down to the complex. There he was met by Tassath, the Vulcan chief operating officer. They had never served together directly, but naturally the overseer of the Federation's main shipyards and the chief engineer of Starfleet's flagship were in regular communication, plus meetings at the odd conference here and there over the years. LaForge had always found Tassath reliable, knowledgeable, resourceful, and perhaps inevitably calm. Today, she greeted him with what he guessed passed for a significant emotional display. A slight furrow of the brows, some tightness in the lips.
Is what we're hearing true? She said.
The embargo on the news about the supernova had been lifted, although Starfleet officers were being requested to use discretion, particularly those directly involved in the project. Still, one could not promote and reassign Jean-Luc Picard, put a Klingon in charge of the Enterprise, commandeer more than a dozen ships, and begin to establish the base of operations for what was plainly going to be a major mission without attracting some attention. Besides, secrecy was more the Romulan way.
"Uh-huh," said LaForge. "And we're going to need ships."
"Ships?"
said T'Soth. "There's going to be a major relief mission. They've asked us to help." That almost startled her.
"The Romulans have asked for Federation help?"
"Can you believe it? Only limited, but we're going to need ships."
"Ships to carry Romulan refugees?"
Her eyes narrowed briefly.
"How many people to transport?"
He lowered his voice.
"A lot."
"Precision would be more helpful, Commander."
"Not quite a billion."
"Again, somewhat imprecise, but slightly more informative."
She gestured to him to follow her.
"You should speak to the senior staff. I've asked them to come and join us at 1500 hours.
That gave LaForge about an hour to get to his assigned quarters, change, pull out his presentation, and check he had everything he needed. Exactly enough time before T'Soth was back at his door to take him to one of the main conference rooms. There were about 2 dozen people there, various heads of departments from across the operation, such as the director of the research lab and several of the principal investigators on the main development programs underway at the base. Production managers, operations managers, quality managers, construction specialists, senior process engineers. He started with a segment from Rafi Musiker's presentation, the section that had blown his mind when he had seen it, showing the blast radius fanning outward from the Romulan star, sucking in world after world. Then he explained Starfleet's mission: to proceed to the outer systems and save as many as possible of the millions of lives at risk there. He described, in broad brushstrokes, what that meant for Utopia Planitia. First, a round of refitting existing ships. Then, a serious commitment to building the number of ships that would be needed to carry out this task as quickly as possible. He was no more than a few minutes in when he sensed that he was not carrying the crowd with him. He finished and said, "Any questions?" There was a silence. Then one of the people at the back said, "This can't be done."
"It's going to have to be," said LaForge.
"We're not magicians," someone else said. "We can't pull thousands of ships out of a hat. This is going to mean a major restructure."
After that, the questions and comments started coming in thick and fast.
"Which projects are we supposed to stop?
Which lines of research are we supposed to be dropping?
Whose damned stupid idea was all this in the first place?"
"Wow," thought LaForge in dismay. "This was not what I expected." He held up his hands.
"Hey now, hold on a minute.
Try to remember, please, exactly what's at stake here. We've been asked to take on responsibility for saving hundreds of millions of people at risk from the effects of this star going supernova."
"The Romulan star," someone called out.
That was enough.
"I don't know what the hell is going on here," LaForge snapped, "but I don't expect crap like that from anyone in Starfleet, and I'm telling you now, if I hear anything like it again, there'll be consequences for the people concerned. This mission is happening, whether you like it or not. It's happening, and it needs ships. We have a fleet to build, in record time, and this is where it's going to happen. You can be a part of it, or else I'll expect your request for separation from the service on my desk within the week."
The room was silent. LaForge looked around. Some people glared back. Others were studying the ground.
"Okay," he said. "I'm going to meet each of you one-to-one. In the meantime, I expect preliminary reports from each division as to how they intend to meet this challenge. Dismissed."
They made their way out, leaving only LaForge and T'Soth behind.
"What the hell was all that about?" said LaForge.
T'Soth looked unperturbed.
"I expected some resistance."
"Resistance? That was nearly a goddamn mutiny."
"I believe that people do not enjoy being asked to put aside their life's work to turn their attention fully to somebody else's project."
Somebody else is... We're going to be saving lives. It's what Starfleet is all about.
Romulan lives.
Now wait a moment, Lieutenant.
She turned away from him and walked toward the door.
Strange as this may seem, Commander LaForge, Romulans are not popular. The people here will do what you order, and they will do their best, but do not expect them to be happy. Again, I say, you are asking people to put aside their life's work and to assist people they have been accustomed to thinking of as their enemy. I suggest you find a reason to persuade them of the benefits.
If you feel that way, Lieutenant Desoth, should I expect your resignation?
She gave a small smile.
Certainly not. Where else could I practice my trade? As you have made clear, this is the only business in town.
She left. He stood for a while, alone in the empty room. It was not the most auspicious start to the task of a lifetime.
Starfleet Intelligence, Office of Romulan Affairs. Rafi Musiker, reeling slightly from the last few hours, walked back into her office, sat down at her desk, and tried to collect her thoughts. The Verity was beautiful. Not the Enterprise, no, but then nothing was, and this was the ship needed for this mission. As they took the tour, the Admiral looked increasingly pleased. He made a point of checking the passenger facilities. They were not spacious, they had a lot of people to move and only a limited number of ships for the moment, but they were comfortable.
There's some real thought gone into this,
Rafi said as they went into a cabin designed for a family unit.
We must remember how frightening this must be for the people we shall be carrying, Picard said. They are leaving behind their homes and many of their possessions. We cannot carry them as if they were cargo. As far as possible, these spaces must make them feel secure, and most of all, they must feel hope. That even though they are forced to leave their old lives, the possibility of a new life lies ahead. Fear, uncertainty, dislocation, all these will lead to trouble. We must prevent that from arising.
Close quarters won't come naturally to many Romulans, she said. Too little privacy. Whatever we can do to lessen the impact of that will make a big difference.
He walked on beside her.
We?
Starfleet, I mean, she fudged.
He carried on down the corridor.
Of course.
That charade had lasted, another 15 minutes max. By the time they had taken a quick look at the daycare area and were kneeling in front of a crate of essential supplies to be issued to each group, checking the quality and durability of the blankets, the hygiene kits, the spare clothes, the pads, they both knew she was accepting. As they walked back to the transporter, he started describing what he believed was the most likely first mission, a small colony on Ectis II, and she pointed out some strategic sensitivities associated with the world's defense grid. And then it was time for her to leave. He reached out and shook her hand.
Welcome to the mission, Commander, he said. I am extremely glad to have you on board.
I'm glad to be able to help, sir.
His grip on her hand tightened, and he looked straight into her eyes. Quietly, he said,
This mission is unprecedented, Rafi. It is going to require as much as you are able to give.
I've become Rafi. I won't let you down, sir.
You have my complete confidence and trust.
Damn it, she thought, sitting back at her desk. That voice.
She'd suspected when she'd first heard him speak at the start of their meeting that she would be persuaded to do whatever he asked. And now here she was, about to contact her husband and her son and tell them that Mommy was going away for who knew how long. She put her hands flat down on her desk and thought,
Do I really want this?
And the answer was plain.
Yes. Yes, I do.
She thought about what she would be leaving on Earth. Gabe, her not-so-little boy anymore. Jay, who did most of the quiet,
steady, constant work that kept an 11-year-old moving around from meal to school to soccer games to sleepovers and still managed to produce his holosculptures. The ramshackle house on the outskirts of Santa Fe, the mess that came from a smart, active kid, an artist, and a busy Starfleet officer. The studio that they had been kind of nearly not quite building for Jay for nearly 5 years. The half-dug vegetable patch. Her office, where she pored over reports late into the night, where she had been sealed for nearly 2 weeks writing the presentation that had landed her this post, coming up every so often to say, "This'll be done soon, Jay, I promise, and then I'll be back." Her home. But thinking of home made her think of all she had seen on the Verity. Those little quarters, where whole families would soon be housed. What that must mean for them to lose everything. She thought, "Is there something wrong with me that I think I should be spending my time with some abstract Romulan kids rather than with my own child?" But the truth was, she knew she had to help. She opened a comm channel. And there was Gabe, gorgeous Gabe, her baby boy. He was eating. He was always eating, just walking around eating. Any day now, the growth spurt would happen, and the last vestiges of the little boy he had once been would be gone, replaced by the makings of a man. "Hey, Gabe," she said. "How are you doing? What have you been up to?" He looked at her like she was entering her dotage. Mom? We saw each other at breakfast."
"I know, I know. How was school? What did you do today?"
"Oh, you know, stuff. Do you want to talk to Dad?"
"Sure, honey bunny."
He pretended to be throwing up.
"Don't call me that," he said, and stepped out of view.
"Dad!" he yelled. "It's Mom! She wants to talk to you!" He looked back over his shoulder and grinned. His lopsided, half-toothed, still-a-boy grin.
"See you later."
And he was off, back to whatever he'd been up to before she interrupted him. She felt that sharp sense of loss every parent feels watching their baby move away from them. She wanted to reach out, scoop him up into her arms and press her face into his hair, capture and savor these brief moments of his childhood before he was gone for good. She thought, "What am I doing?" and answered herself at once. "The job I'm supposed to do. Making a difference." She blinked twice and rubbed her eyes.
"Hey, Rafi," said Jay. "You don't usually call at this time. What's up?"
"Honey," she said, "I have news."
"Oh, yeah?"
He was fiddling with something on the desk, not quite looking at her.
"Good news?"
"Big news."
He looked up properly, and they embarked on what she had correctly predicted would be one of the most difficult conversations of her life so far. 9 days later, unpacking in her new quarters on the Verity, she lifted out a holo picture of the three of them out in the Grand Canyon, all happiness. Her little family. For a brief and terrifying moment, she thought of the vast distance that was about to open between them all. But then she pulled herself together.
6 months, Jay. We'll give it 6 months, and then we'll see whether or not it's working. And if it's not, I'll come right back. I promise."
There were so many promises. This one she meant to keep.
Utopia Planitia Shipyards, Mars.
LaForge, filing his daily report to Picard, wasn't sure how long he would be able to keep the upbeat tone going. His first weeks on Mars had not been the success he had expected. The pushback against the mission that had been expressed in that first meeting was still ongoing, and he was struggling to think of ways to break through. There were folks here who, even after hearing what the Romulans were facing, were willing to shrug and look the other way. How did you persuade them? If you could look at desperate people, refugees who were fleeing their homes and could never return, and simply turn away, then there was, in LaForge's opinion, something not quite right about you. LaForge knew that some people found engineers odd. The specialist knowledge and language, the fixation on detail, the ability to focus on a problem that meant 36 hours could go by without anyone noticing as long as the coffee and the snacks kept coming. Not to mention the goofy sense of humor, the penchant for terrible puns, and the fondness for science fiction. Yep, the wider world, in general, thought engineers were, to put it frankly, weird. Hey, he wasn't disagreeing. He liked himself exactly the way he was. Every so often, though, there was someone who got it. Someone who saw that these smart goofballs were something special. Curious, open-minded, flexible, and practical. Picard was one. Picard understood. And within the tribe, of course, you knew the truth. You knew that what you brought to the table was the ability to change the world, to take the material stuff of the universe and from it build tools and machines and processes and systems that transformed lives. That was what this mission was all about, wasn't it? To gather together a group of the smartest people alive and, through their dedication, intelligence, imagination, and sound understanding of the physical properties of the universe, build tools and machines and processes and systems that would save millions of lives. When LaForge had set out for Mars, he had assumed that his people, his tribe of offbeat, pun-loving geniuses, would also understand. An incredible, daunting opportunity to do what they did best on a scale that they could barely imagine, and not for the purposes of war, but for the purposes of peace and cooperation. An offer of friendship. It seemed to LaForge to be exactly what Starfleet was meant to do. A simple, magnificent equation. Ingenuity plus hope equals change. He thought he would arrive at the shipyards explaining what they had to do and be met with the immediate enthusiasm of the engineer who, presented with what everyone was saying was an insurmountable problem, replied, "Yeah, you say that, but has anyone thought about trying this?" But that was not how things were panning out. The door chime sounded. "Come in," he called out. Yet another department head, he guessed, about to explain to him in no uncertain terms that his latest request was not achievable. A woman in uniform trimmed in engineering gold marched in. She was small, not much more than 5 feet, solid, short, curly hair, 50-something. Commander's pips. Her eyes were flashing. His heart sank. She walked right over to his desk, dropped a pile of pads there, and stood with her hands upon her hips. Had they met? He had a feeling he would have remembered meeting a hobbit. He pulled one of the pads over and started a quiet search for her name and file. Commander Estella McKenzie. "Hey," he said, trying his best to sound upbeat. "How can I help?" "Physically manufacturing the components," she said. "Have you even begun to think about that?" LaForge blinked. "Excuse me?" "We want an accelerated program of shipbuilding, and that's great. Up to 10,000 ships, you said, within the next few years. And why not? We're the best engineers in the quadrant, possibly two quadrants. But there are limits to what we can replicate and to what we can automate. Do you understand what that means?" She glared at him, which he took to be a signal that he was now allowed to speak. "I guess I think it means..." She blew out a breath that made her sound like a pissed-off camel.
No, you don't understand. Let me show you."
To his bewilderment, she began pulling ship components out from her pocket, dumping them onto the desk in front of him. "Hey," he said, "do you mind not..." She cut him off.
"These two here are components used in the forward sensors."
She rummaged in another pocket.
"This one is used to monitor and regulate temperatures in the warp plasma conduits. This one goes in the air filtration."
His desk was starting to look like a junkyard.
"I know what they are, Commander," he said, allowing some of the irritation he was feeling to creep into his voice.
"Bravo, so you do know your stuff. So tell me,
What do they have in common?
LaForge stared down at the heap in front of him. Engineers were good at patterns. There was no discernible pattern to these that he could see.
I'll give you a clue, she said. Since you're looking clueless, it's nothing to do with function. Think about how they're made,
LaForge said.
They're made by hand. Each one of these is individually manufactured. That's right. And now we hit a wall. Because we don't have enough people.
People?
To make the components.
A manufacturing issue. A personnel issue. LaForge began to do what he always did when faced with a problem, which was to try to break it down into its simplest terms. If there were not enough people, what could be done about that? How could you make more people available? How could you bolster the workforce? Perhaps some kind of stint that would count as credit at the academy. What sort of numbers was she even talking about? If we need more people, he said, we can get more people. Mackenzie stared at him.
The average human takes roughly 18 years to reach maturity. I assume you're not prepared to wait that long, and that you're not envisaging a workforce based on child labor.
I am not, said LaForge. I am not keen on either of those options. Can we draft people over from across Starfleet? Again, that camel-like harumph. Yeah, she was really pissed off.
This is specialist work we're talking about, not whacking a nail into a piece of timber, she snapped. It's skilled work. It takes time to learn. There aren't the people. There aren't the bodies.
LaForge's heart felt like a stone in his chest. Yet again, resistance. People telling him that what had to be done couldn't be done. So what you're telling me is that what I want to do is physically impossible? That I can't speed up manufacture the way we need? Mackenzie looked at him in absolute fury.
What? No, 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 of course I'm not saying that. For goodness sake, do you think I'd come in here with a problem and not have the solution?
No, said LaForge humbly. I'm sorry. Please go on. She took a deep breath.
What do you know about bioneural circuitry?
I know a little.
Yes, well, I know a lot.
LaForge glanced down at her file. She wasn't lying. She was the Federation's foremost authority on the damn stuff, specializing in its practical applications for starship design.
Don't look at your pad, she said sternly, as if addressing a freshman class. Look at what I'm showing you.
Yes, sir, he muttered and obeyed.
You'll recall, or will have informed yourself from my file open in front of you, that my recent work on bioneural circuitry has been concerned with seeing how far we can push the smart elements of the manufacturing systems, how far they can learn. Because looking at these components and thinking how much we rely on handcrafting the damn things seems to me to be insane. Ideally, I want the things to be as self-replicating as possible.
How far have you come with that?
Huh? Oh. Nowhere. I've persuaded a couple of simpler components to self-replicate, but they degrade far too quickly. You've barely installed them, and you're ripping them out. No, there's a decade's work in that yet, and we don't have a decade, do we?
You said you had a solution, Commander. Am I about to hear it?
You are. Because after a month tearing my hair out, I realized I was coming to this problem the wrong way. These complex components need to be individually assembled, but we need to mass-produce. Which means more people.
Like you said, 18 years to grow a person. Not an artificial one. He sat back in his chair. Say what?
Androids, Commander. Synthetics. They're fast, smart, they can be trained to perform specific tasks.
Disappointment washed over LaForge. This stocky, blunt woman had, for a moment, made him think that she was on to something. But she wasn't. They're nowhere near this at the Daystrom Institute. Surely,
I don't know about that because I'm not an expert. But I will bet you every single day of my accumulated leave that those clever people at the Daystrom Institute have never looked at my work. Why should they? What have self-replicating ship components got to do with creating artificial life? But Something like this project has never been attempted before, and we need bold ideas. Bioneural circuitry is smart, for certain definitions of smart. Androids, synthetics, they're smart too. Let's put this work together and see what comes out the other end.
LaForge stared down at the components in front of him. He had watched some of them being manufactured, had seen the careful and precise work involved. They needed to speed this process up somehow.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mackenzie said.
Yes, said LaForge. You're talking about a new kind of synthetic life.
He looked over at her. She was smiling, her face lit up and transformed. A brilliant professor seeing her brightest student make a breakthrough.
That's right. A new kind of synthetic life. One not based on current positronic models, but on what we know about bioneural circuitry.
Suddenly, in his mind's eye, he had an image of these synthetics working crisply and quickly and efficiently around the clock, providing him with everything he needed to make this rapid expansion of the fleet possible. For the first time since he had arrived on Mars, he felt cautiously optimistic.
Synthetics?
He fell back in his chair. This was amazing. This was brilliant. I didn't even know that non-Soong-type androids were possible. Mackenzie cleared her throat.
Well, don't get too excited, she said gruffly. We're not there yet. We need an expert on androids, for one thing.
I'll get onto the Daystrom Institute immediately. He turned to the computer on his desk and sent a message to the one man who he knew could do this, Bruce Maddox. Bruce, I'm on Mars. I need to see you as quickly as possible. As he sent the message, he thought of Data, and a pang of loss went through him. He longed suddenly for his friend. These new synthetics, they would not be Data. Nothing could replace Data. They would be something else. They would be exactly what was needed, but not entirely what was wanted. He glanced up again at Mackenzie. She was standing stock still, staring down at the components she had brought. She looked tired and deflated suddenly, as if she had given everything that she had to give. He felt a sudden rush of affection for her.
Hey, he said softly. You know, you're the first person here on Mars who has made me think that what we have to do can be done. You are without doubt my favorite person on Mars, and right now you are possibly my favorite person in known space.
She smiled. Rather sweetly, her cheeks dimpled.
Have I? She said. Am I? Oh, I'm glad. I'm so, so glad.
Suddenly her eyes filled with tears.
I can't stop thinking about those poor people, she said, having to leave their homes behind. The absolute terror of it all. I haven't slept since your presentation, Commander. I had to think of something I could do. I had to help.
He came around his desk to join her. He put his arm around her shoulder and gave her a quick hug. She sniffled and rallied and cleared her throat.
Yes, well, she said. Like I said, I don't come into a room to tell someone about a problem without having a solution in my pocket.
You sure don't, he said. He picked up one of her pads and handed it to her.
Okay, he said. Bioneural circuitry. Run me through the basics.
As he listened to her speak, his heart rose. The best of Starfleet, he thought. Ingenuity, hope, change. We can do this.
3. Admiral's log. Our first mission has been confirmed. As expected, we have been formally requested by the Romulan government to remove the population of the mining colony on Ectis 2 to Arnath 4. This is, of course, very easy to say, when the reality is that we shall be facilitating the removal of nearly 10,000 souls from their homes, carrying them for slightly over 2 months to their new world, and then assisting, to a small degree, in their settlement there. I believe, however, that we have done the very best that we can to prepare for this mission. Now we must act in good faith and learn all we can from this operation to make the next expedition even more successful. During this brief pause, this hiatus before the whirl of activity that is about to follow, I must take a moment to remind myself how profoundly grateful I am to everyone who has willingly put aside everything to commit themselves to this mission. Above all, I thank the stars for the work done behind the scenes by my new XO, Commander Rafi Musica. I am aware that through her efforts, what should be problems are presented to me as wholly solved. Captain Kirsten Clancy has been liaising with the Romulans, and Rafi is, of course, a specialist in Romulan affairs. I have the distinct impression that Clancy's tendency toward micromanagement has been a burden that my XO has also borne on my account, and I am greatly appreciative. This has left me with the time to fully concentrate on staffing, coordinating, and directing the fleet. On Earth, Commander Bowie has rapidly constructed an organization and processes to respond to our requirements for materiel and staff. She and Lieutenant Call are masters of the concise briefing. Messages from Commander Geordi LaForge are proving an interesting read. I sense behind his words some resistance from the Yard's engineers at these new and overwhelming demands that are being placed upon them. I understand, too, that for many, this will mean setting aside research for many years that may well have been the chief concern. But if any officer can corral them toward a common goal, it is surely Geordi, among the most optimistic, practical, and sincere officers of my acquaintance. Tomorrow it begins, the most complex project ever mounted by Starfleet and the Federation. In between the briefings, duty rosters, charts, files, data, and all the necessary bureaucracy, let us not forget our goal, to protect and save life.
Starship Verity. Picard sat in his chair on the bridge, ostensibly at ease. In fact, he was taut as a wire. The fleet, 15 ships in total, with the starship Verity front and center, was 15 minutes away from setting out on its first mission of mercy. All around, the bridge crew was busy with last-minute systems checks, engineering reports, all the vital preparations for the voyage. They were a fine crew. He knew that he should say something to them, in fact, to the whole fleet embarking on this journey to mark the occasion, but he could not quite decide on the appropriate words. Not for the first time in his life he felt the terrible isolation of command. Not for the first time in his life he reminded himself that this melancholy always settled upon him before any major voyage, that this might prove to be the voyage that would define him. Rafi, beside him, touched his arm.
Penny for your thoughts, sir.
He straightened up and cleared his throat. Contemplating our mission, that's all.
That's all, eh?
That's all.
Huh. Big thoughts. I'll need to give you more than a penny for them. Hey, you know how the advice goes about how to eat an elephant?
This should be good, he thought. Do tell, Commander.
One bite at a time, Admiral. How else do you think you eat a damn elephant? One bite at a time. How about we get the ship out of dock before we worry about anything else?
He relaxed. From the corner of his eye, he saw her nod, satisfied that her intervention had had the desired effect, and turn her attention back to proceedings.
One bite at a time.
Yes, these were simple maneuvers performed thousands of times. He need not worry for the moment. Lieutenant Marshall, handling comms, turned to him.
Admiral, incoming message from Starfleet Command. It's Captain Clancy.
Christ's sakes, muttered Rafi. What now? Probably checking we've packed our lunches.
She caught his eye.
Sorry, sir.
Picard, smile firmly suppressed, rose from his seat. In my ready room, please, Lieutenant. His eyes twinkled at Rafi. The bridge is yours, Commander. In the quiet of his ready room, he took the message.
Clancy appeared on screen.
Admiral Picard, I wanted to wish you the best of luck.
Thank you, Kirsten.
Also, before you leave, I'm sending someone over to join your team. Her name is Coley Jokan. She's a specialist on refugee relocation. This, thought Picard, was typical Clancy. To decide without consultation that there was a problem, and to provide without asking some kind of solution. He bit back his instinctive response, which was to say that he was perfectly capable of crewing his own damn ship, and said,
"The name sounds Bajoran."
"That's right. Born in a Rankath refugee camp at the end of the occupation. She knows her business." He was taking along numerous experts on refugee resettlement. Why was Clancy so keen on this one?
"I'm sure she'll be an asset."
"She's wholly committed, very focused. I think you'll get along with her."
She sounded as if she might be hard work. "Indubitably."
There was a pause. Clancy looked about to say more, then clearly thought better. "Well, good luck. You go with all of Starfleet's well wishes for the success of this mission."
"Thank you, Kirsten. Verity out."
Picard sat for a moment or two, contemplating the screen. He always sensed in his dealings with Clancy some, what would the word be? He hesitated to call it mistrust. Misalignment? That was fairer. Despite the same training, the same uniform, and the same stated ideals and values, he felt at odds with her in some undefined but crucial way. Picard filed this away for future consideration. He had a mission to get underway, and besides, none of this was the fault of Coley Jokan. He must welcome her with good grace and accept her services in a similar fashion. When he went back out onto the bridge, he saw a young Bajoran woman, neat in a blue Starfleet uniform, Lieutenant Pips, who started at the sight of him. Rafi behind her was pointing and mouthing, "Who the hell is this?" He stepped forward to greet her. She was slightly built, below average height, common for a Bajoran of her generation, the usual, if sad, effect of a malnourished childhood.
"Lieutenant Coley, I presume."
"Yes, Admiral."
"Welcome aboard. You arrive in the nick of time."
"I'm very glad about that." In a quiet voice, she added, "I'm aware you didn't request me, sir. I approached Captain Clancy and asked to be assigned to this mission. I am extremely grateful to you for allowing me this opportunity. I cannot think of any more important work to be done right now than this." He smiled gently. She was young, sincere, and Clancy's faux pas was not her fault.
"We are in full accord. I look forward to serving alongside you."
He took his seat, collected himself. Clancy, it turned out, had inadvertently done him a favor. Rather than sitting and brooding over what to say, he had been distracted. And now the words came easily. He directed Lieutenant Marshall to patch his voice throughout the fleet and spoke.
"This is Admiral Jean-Luc Picard speaking to you from the starship Verity. Across this fleet, our combined experience encompasses many hundreds of years, thousands of worlds, and hundreds of thousands of missions. Today, we embark upon Starfleet's greatest mission, the most honest, the most heartfelt, and the most necessary of tasks. To put aside centuries of doubt, fear, and mistrust, and to offer to our neighbors in their hour of need the unconditional hand of friendship." He saw Coley nodding. Taking heart, he continued, "I'm grateful to each one of you for your decision to join me. You have left families, posts, and homes that you love dearly in order to commit to saving lives. I say to you that there is no duty higher than the preservation of life. Let us take up our duties with courage and with hope. With our talents and resources, we will achieve success, not for plaudits or medals or gratitude, but because it is the right thing to do, and because we are able to do it." He finished. Coley began to clap, and soon a ripple of applause went around the bridge. Lieutenant Marshall patched in comms from the bridges of the other 14 ships, and he heard the reaction there. Resolute. Determined. He turned to the helm. Lieutenant Miller?
Go on, Rafi whispered. They're dying for you to say it.
And why not?
Engage.
He felt the delight from around his own bridge, and whoops and cheers from the other ships. His own full smile came naturally and without inhibition. The Verity moved forward. Rafi, in the seat beside him, put two thumbs up. Then she quirked an eyebrow up and flicked a glance toward Colby. Well? He gave a curt nod. The fleet, sleek, beautiful, hopeful, the best of Starfleet, departed. So it began. Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. Estella McKenzie turned out to be exactly the ally that LaForge needed. She had fired up engines that he hadn't even known were present. Some people were willing to stand up to everyone no matter what, and McKenzie was one of them. There were, of course, some requests for transfer, all of which were allowed. But even T'Sath cautiously changed sides. Once she was on board, the rest fell into line. Slowly, as the weeks passed, the work began to move forward. The briefings became less combative and agonizing. More and more, people started to wander past LaForge's office saying, "Hey, I had this idea." Soon enough, he was confident that he could leave for the Daystrom Institute without everything coming crashing to a halt. The campus of the Daystrom Institute, where the Division of Advanced Synthetic Research was housed, was set high on a clifftop overlooking the Pacific. LaForge passed through security. As he walked along the white corridors, he pondered his meeting with Bruce Maddox. It was not easy to feel goodwill towards someone who had tried to turn one of your best friends into a box of spare parts. Data had forgiven Maddox, and LaForge had to honor that, even if he struggled with it. Not for the first time, LaForge thought, Data had turned out to be the fullest, the best, the most human of them all. Measured, thoughtful, forgiving.
I try to live up to your example, Data, but some people sure make it hard.
Dr. Bruce Maddox, tall and lean, welcomed him offhandedly. I've heard of McKenzie's work, of course, he said, his eyes drifting to the open files on his desk, but it's nothing like my research. She's making... He gave a slight smile. Well, what does it amount to? Machines. Complex and organic, but not life.
I'm sure she'd be interested to hear your take on her work, LaForge said dryly.
In fact, he'd like to sit ringside for that. Hell, he'd sell tickets. McKenzie would make mincemeat of Maddox. Maddox had the grace to look embarrassed. I don't mean that what she's doing isn't difficult, or indeed laudable, and obviously there are a huge number of practical applications, but it isn't what I'm doing. They're two very different approaches. But I think you know that already, LaForge. I have to confess I'm pretty puzzled as to why you're here. He didn't look puzzled at all. In fact, he looked not in the least bit interested. His eyes were already turning back to the file on his desk. LaForge said, "What have you heard about the Romulan supernova?"
"The what?"
How had he not heard?
Jeez, thought LaForge. This guy.
The Romulan sun is going supernova. Light dawned in Maddox's eyes. Oh, yes, the refugee mission. Sorry, I'm teaching a graduate class at the moment, and if you could see the state of some of their papers, you'd understand my distraction. Yes, of course. What has that got to do with bioneural circuitry?
Do I have to spell this out?
We're helping to relocate hundreds of millions of Romulans, LaForge said. It's demanding significant breakthroughs in starship construction in order to be able to supply enough ships to get the job done. Most of the research facilities at Utopia Planitia have been turned toward the problem.
I bet they're pleased.
Excuse me?
said LaForge frostily.
Well, who wants to stop their research? Said Maddox. I can see it's for a good cause, but...
You're gonna love what's coming next, thought LaForge.
So you're working on advancing starship construction technology, said Maddox. That's going to cause some significant engineering problems, but those guys are great. What do you need from me today?
There are some insurmountable problems when it comes to the manufacture of certain components, said LaForge. It's skilled work, but we can't train enough people quickly enough to meet demand. We need another solution.
I suppose there might be a bioneural solution there, said Maddox. Intelligent circuitry? Well, I say intelligent. Considerable learning capability, but not sentience.
It's more complicated than that, but you've got the general idea, said LaForge.
Great for Mackenzie and her work.
Yep, but the reality is... LaForge leaned forward in his seat. Listen, Bruce, the tasks are so complicated. We're thinking about a range of non-sentient androids based on bioneural circuitry to do the assembly work. Maddox looked vaguely interested.
I guess that might work. Good job you've got Mackenzie. If anyone can do it, it'll be her. From what I've heard, she's dogged.
Okay, thought LaForge. I am going to have to spell this out. I want you to work on this with Mackenzie. Maddox stared at him.
Why on earth would I do that?
LaForge was startled. He hadn't anticipated that question.
I mean, said Maddox, I've read her work, sure. It has very little in common with what I do. Like I said, they're two very different approaches.
He looked at LaForge. LaForge looked back.
That's not what you're saying, is it, Geordi?
LaForge shook his head.
No, said Maddox.
Bruce, said LaForge, seeing the explosion coming, it's what's needed right now.
You want me to stop work, stop my work, my life's work, and start building...
He grasped around for the right word.
Toys?
Yes, said LaForge simply. And before you say anything else, I'm asking because we have millions of lives to save. Can you understand that? Sure, this will mean stopping your work, but for a good purpose. What use, he said, is the potential of artificial sentient life if it comes at the cost of all these lives, these real lives that right now are in desperate trouble? I need you, Bruce. I need your expertise, and you can do good work, real good, right now.
As opposed to the work I've been doing up to now. What's that been?
Maddox looked petulant. It was the only word for it.
Nobody has ever taken my work seriously.
LaForge, thinking of Data, didn't take a swing at him. This is what we need, Bruce, he said. Hey, I can't compel you to do anything, but I can put it to you plainly. This is what Admiral Picard needs, what the mission needs, what Starfleet needs, and most of all, it's what millions of desperate people need. I'm asking you to give a little.
A little? You're asking for, what, 5 years of my life? A decade? More?
LaForge struggled to answer. Could be two, could be five.
I see, said Maddox.
I'm asking you to give what's needed, said LaForge, to help save all these lives. Maddox sat back in his chair, arms folded, and stared bitterly at LaForge.
So no compulsion, then.
Like I said, I can't force you to do anything, but this is where the resources are going.
So no compulsion other than soon I'll be able to do next to nothing. I guess it's only a matter of time before the lab space gets reassigned, then the damn desk itself.
A silence fell on the room. Maddox glared at the wall.
Non-sentient synthetics, he said at last. What a waste. What a goddamn waste.
You're on board, said LaForge cautiously.
For God's sake, Geordi, what choice do I have?
Maddox pulled up the latest file Mackenzie had sent over.
All right, talk me through the basics.
Well, thought LaForge, I'm glad to have you on board. I think.
Institute of Astronomy, Cambridge, Earth. Cambridge in autumn, early in the morning, had a special magic. Light mist curled around the fens. In the distance, the colleges were hazy and mysterious. Dr. Amal Safadi finished her run with a sprint, reaching the gate a little below the 20-minute mark. Not bad. She rested on the black-painted metal, getting her breath back, sipping water. A big reddish-brown cow munching at the thick grass pondered her. A heron flew past. This, she thought, was not a bad life. She showered, changed, and breakfasted, but took her time getting on her bike to head over to work. The Institute of Astronomy was a little way out of town to the north and west, and usually she liked to be at her desk early. This morning, she found all manner of small things to do at home. Check the power source on the replicator, fiddle with the light settings, stare at the empty bird boxes. At last, she could find nothing else to do, and she made herself start the day. Leave the house, unlock the bike, push off on the pedals. Arriving at the cycle park, she fiddled around with the lock for a while.
This is ridiculous. Go and make sure. You can't put this off any longer.
Elena Richter, another astronomer with whom she shared her office, looked up when she walked in. Elena was just back from a conference in Hawaii and seemed very relaxed.
Hey, you're late this morning.
They had a chat about the conference. The keynote had gone over brilliantly. They tapped coffee mugs and toasted Elena's success. After that, Safadi had to sit down at her desk. The screen came on at her touch. She stared at the model she had run the previous evening. Her results hadn't gone away, and she was going to have to admit that they weren't going to go away.
Elena, she said at last, can you take a look at this?
Seeing her friend's face, Elena came right over.
What's the matter? The data sets came in while you were away, Safadi said, turning the screen around for Elena to see. I started modeling the rate of expansion of the Romulan supernova based on them, and, well, take a look.
Safadi watched as Elena went through the model. She watched her frown turn into concentration, watched her concentration turn into outright alarm.
This can't be right, Elena said. Amal, have you checked this? Stupid question, sorry. I can't find a mistake.
The two women sat and watched the model for a while, watched the concentric rings move outward, faster than ever before.
If I'm correct, the rate of expansion is much faster, and the blast radius is going to be much bigger than anything we thought was going to happen. Holy shit, muttered Elena.
She started to look through the figures again.
That's another 10 worlds. Holy shit. Okay, let's go through this again, step by step.
By mid-morning, two more colleagues, including their group director, Dernyam Bekri, had come past Safadi's desk and looked through both model and calculations. Others, sensing that something was up, wandered past and peered into the office but didn't interrupt, particularly when the door closed and the four of them held a conference deciding what to do next. Dernyam, sitting in Safadi's chair and studying the model yet again, said,
If it's any consolation, it's a beautiful piece of work.
Thank you, said Safadi, but problematic, I think.
I'd say, muttered Graysh, a talented but rather anxious Bolian. This is a drastic change from the previous model. Romulus hit sooner, more worlds coming within the blast range.
I know, said Safadi. That was based on data supplied to us by the Romulan Space Authority. This is the first model that's based completely on data sets taken from our own readings, which suggests
that the data supplied by the Romulans is in some way flawed, said Dernyam.
Do you mean flawed, said Elena, or false?
There was a short pause. Graysh started twisting his fingers around.
I have no evidence, said Durnium calmly, that the Romulans have supplied us with false data. We have a model based on what they sent us, and a model based on what we ourselves have observed. Perhaps their scientists simply aren't as good as Amor.
But surely they wouldn't lie about their data, Graysh said. It seems to me, said Elena, that that is exactly what they would lie about.
But why? Said Graysh. Why would they do that with so many lives at stake?
This takes months off their time to evacuate the homeworld. Years, possibly. They should have started yesterday. Why would they lie?
Why, indeed, said Durnium. She turned to Safadi. Amal, if I'm struggling with anything, it's getting these figures to make sense given what we would expect from a nova of this type. Why is this one expanding so rapidly?
Safadi looked back at her unhappily.
I don't know. It's hard to find a natural explanation that works with the data.
So a non-natural one? Elena frowned.
A deliberate attack?
On the Romulan star?
Durnium looked horrified.
Well, it's certainly thrown a major power into complete disarray, Elena pointed out.
That would be monstrous, Durnium said.
No, I can't believe that.
Safadi cut through.
I'm not going to speculate on anything that I don't have hard data to support, and I don't think any of us should, not least because of the politics. What matters right now is the lives that are at stake. We are dealing with a much bigger phenomenon than we originally believed, hitting harder, hitting faster, and that's going to have an impact on the relief mission.
She looked again at her figures.
If I could visit the Romulan home system, get some better readings closer to their sun.
There was another short silence. They all knew how much secrecy had surrounded the Romulan datasets. All four of them had been asked by Starfleet Intelligence to carry out extra security checks, fill in extra non-disclosure forms, and so on and so on.
As if I was going to sell Romulan data, Elena had muttered. Who the hell would I sell it to?
And, of course, there was a series of carefully outlined protocols surrounding what they could do with the data and who could and should be informed.
We're obliged, said Durnium, to notify Romulan affairs if anything significant arises in our work here. What I want to do is make absolutely sure that these figures are rock solid.
Amal doesn't get things wrong, said Elena.
No, she doesn't, said Durnium. But Romulan affairs doesn't know that, and their opposite numbers in the Star Empire... I want every single piece of this code scrutinized, every line, every formula, every function. When we are sure, absolutely sure, as a group, that this is unassailable, that's when we contact Romulan affairs. But we need to be quick, because if this is true...
They all watched once again as 10 more worlds came within the blast radius and were consumed by its implacable force.
Well, said Durnium, we can see what that means.
They went back to work, except Safadi, who followed Durnium to her office, closing the door behind her.
I'm sorry, she said. I know this is going to cause problems.
Durnium peered at her over her glasses.
You're not responsible for a supernova, she said. You're only responsible for studying and interpreting the data. If that data means bad news, there are other people responsible for acting on it.
As ever, Safadi felt safe in this woman's hands, supported and secure.
I did have one suggestion to make. I can't get over how different our model is from the Romulan model.
It is a puzzle, said Durnium dryly.
I've used a lot of Nokum Vritet's work in the past. I even heard him speak once, that time he was allowed to uplink to the Delta IV conference. He's an exemplary space scientist. I can't believe the discrepancies.
We have the best of all possible worlds here, Durnium said.
Science that, even if it's not entirely understood, is respected.
our expertise, respected. Politicians, Starfleet officers, they give us the resources to be able to do our work, and they trust our results when we deliver them. They may not like what we have to say, but they